This podcast is a part of the Neuhoff Media Podcast Network.
On the Noon Agribusiness Show, Justin Brook is with us, President Clear Frontier. But Justin's got some interesting ties to things that are going on worldwide as we speak. Justin, for a good time, spent about a number of years, 6 years in Ukraine, lived there, worked as a farm manager, and worked very closely in the agriculture industry throughout Ukraine. So we thought it was important to try to get somebody on the phone here recently on this Noon Show to talk a little bit about what is going on in Ukraine with some of a firsthand opinion and still talking to people over in that country. So, Justin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
Okay, Justin, the last couple of days, 2 weeks or so, your feelings when you see what's going on over there, when you see those TV images, the video brought back. It's appalling to us, but, I mean, you've walked that land. You've seen those soils grow, things. You have friends that still live there. Just give us your initial opinion of what you're seeing right now in Ukraine.
Yeah, it's a gut-wrenching sight to see what's happening, both in the cities, but ultimately for me out in the countryside, and probably more so to the people that are living there. That's home. And, you know, as we look at it from an American perspective, there's a lot of people there that don't have a lot of other places to go, nor a lot of financial resources to go there. When I left in 2014, I believe the minimum wage was $143 a month. And so if you take that as a perspective, there's a lot of people that live in villages or on the edges of some of these towns that they live a pretty simple life. And so for them to pack up and, let's say, go to Poland or Romania, there's a lot of people that don't necessarily have connections to the outside world or places to go. And so I look at that as pretty gut-wrenching and pretty difficult to watch and see what's happening both to their lives and the humanitarian aspect of it, and then ultimately for me, back to the agriculture perspective of it as far as what's going on with it. Farm and the crops and what needs to be going on right now if you're there trying to farm so you can be in position to actually have a harvestable crop. And so it's a difficult sight to see. I've seen a lot of places on TV and on videos of things going on where you look at it and you say, man, I was there, or I lived there. I saw a tank last week in Nikolaev on a street where literally I used to park my Dodge pickup, which I bought from the U.S., every day, and there was a tank sitting there in place of it. So it's pretty difficult to watch and see, but it's the facts of life, I guess.
And so farmers there in Ukraine here, Justin, are trying to deal with the facts of whether or not they're going to grow food for hopefully their own country, for Ukraine, not for Russia at this point in time, but it's their business. It's their attempt to try to put food and things into that population there. They've got to be staring out at those fields right now, trying to figure out what is next. As you talk to people still in Ukraine right now, what is next for those farmers that are trying to figure out, hopefully they're safe and alive, but what they're going to do for this upcoming growing season?
Yeah, Steve, I think the background to it, and for anybody listening, so in Ukraine, typically you're going to plant your winter crops, which is going to be winter rapeseed, winter wheat, and winter barley. You know, and those are going to go in August, September, October of the fall. You'll plant your spring crops about when we would here, about April 15th, start planting corn, and then typically into sunflowers and possibly some peas or soybeans, depending where you're at. So typically what's happening this time of year is you come through about first week of February to 15th of February through mid to late March, is you're putting on your nitrogen on your wheat, barley, and your rapeseed. As it's starting to come out of dormancy and take off, you're putting on ammonium nitrate or urea in order to get that going. So right now, that's what everybody should be doing there. A lot of that gets done typically at night or in the evenings as it freezes up and you can go out and travel without making track. The guys I'm talking to right now, some of them are spreading fertilizer. There's surprisingly a decent amount of people out trying to work in fields. You can't work at night because of the curfews, one, and number two, the risk that you'd be attacked with lights out in the field. So everybody's doing stuff during the day from a safety standpoint. And the guys that had nitrogen, for example, that they had taken possession of and they got, they're trying to figure out how to balance that across how much they should put on crops and save for what they want to put on spring crops to be able to do that. And then there ultimately comes back to the question of, are we even going to be able to harvest these crops in the fall and get our spring crops in? What's going to happen with it? I spoke with the guy that was my right-hand man for the 7 years I was there and took over and still runs the farm in western Ukraine, west of Lviv, which sits right along that Polish border. And they've been relatively safe there. They haven't had any attacks in Lviv. It's where you see a lot of the refugees going across into Poland there. So they've had regular, relatively stable work environments to continue working and move forward. And so that's what they've been doing, is trying to get fertilizer on the crops so that they can be prepared if things hold together, that they'll be able to grow that crop. One of the things he told me this morning was they're not able to get any chemicals that basically aren't in country. They don't think they're going to be able to get. And typically in Ukraine, most farmers there, much like here, will get their chemicals and a lot of their fertilizer on credit from who they're buying it from to be paid for after harvest. And as of either yesterday or today, pretty well all those big chemical companies said it's cash only for what we've got in hand. We're not doing anything on credit, which is going to be a real challenge for a lot of the bigger farms that typically use the credit facility from a lot of the chemical companies. And there's also going to be a limitation on some of the products, what they could typically get that they just aren't going to be able to get their hands on. All is going to equal into a reduction or a challenge for that production standpoint that we're going through for this year there.
Supply chain issues that just kind of that don't even equate to the supply chain issues that we're having here in our own country. Would they have a lot of on-farm storage of these things in the first place? Or since, Justin, they're bought on credit, are they going hand-to-mouth here? Are they, you know, kind of a lot of like normal North American farmers where they were waiting for a delivery of that this spring?
Yeah, you're going to have a bit of both. A lot of your fertilizer will come in one-ton totes. And so for a lot of guys, if you've got storage and you can get that in and get it stored, you'll have farms that will have some of that in supply. A lot of it, typically, we would get in, you know, as close as we could to planting time and take it in. And it's the same on the chemicals. You know, historically, there's been a decent amount of corruption or theft in places like Ukraine and Russia. And so a lot of times you try not to sit on an over-excessive amount of that stuff just from a managing risk as well as managing cash flow. So they're definitely going to have challenges on getting a lot of those type of products as you look at the broader spectrum all across the country. Ultimately, the question will be how much farming actually gets done from the Dnieper River, basically from Kyiv, south to Odessa as you go east in there where the heavier fighting is going and more of that, which is a big portion of that ag swath, and that might end up freeing up some stuff that could be used in the west. But ultimately, yeah, you're going to have what we have for supply chain issues on steroids over there for what guys really need from a farming basis.
The farmers that might be able to get something planted or continue to raise what went in this fall, Justin, what are they saying about any ability to sell it or move it or market that crop with worries about the Black Sea and places like Odessa?
Yeah, to be fair, it's not a conversation I've had a lot of with the guys there, simply because everybody's head is really around the war at hand and trying to get done what they can do with the people on their team or farmhands that they have left that are still there that are not fighting. One of the questions I was talking with this morning with Vlad about was, I said, hey, how are you guys going to be able to handle that come July when you need to start cutting winter crops? And he said, I don't know. He said, honestly, it's too far down the line for all the problems we got facing us to even think about that. The reality is, if you end up blocking off the Odessa port, then that grain will have to go west through into Poland. And it'll have to go into the EU that way, which is where a lot of the grain out of western Ukraine goes anyway, moves across to the west. And just for anybody that's never been there or knows this, that after the Second World War, there's a different size gauge track for rail that runs between western Europe and eastern Europe. And so consequently, when you move grain out of Ukraine into Poland. You get to the border there, they have to raise those cars up and switch the running gear underneath them in order to go on to the tracks going to Western Europe. So you've got some grain facilities where that can be offloaded and reloaded or processed. But for actual grain that moves further on, you actually got to switch the gauge under the wheels in order to move it across onto a different size track. But ultimately, that's going to end up being their market, is going to be Poland and a bit down towards Romania, for example, further south. But the vast majority of that will probably have to go through Poland, as I'm afraid they're not going to have another exit for it. And the other question is going to be, is a lot of that grain going to leave the country this year? Is it all going to stay to try to feed the population that's there?
Right.
None of which I have the answer to.
No, and they're indelicate questions, right? I mean, I'm asking just a question that eventually you get to, but as you mentioned, when you talk to friends and folks there in Ukraine, Justin, it's day-to-day. It's not too much worried about trying to market a crop that hasn't been planted yet, but you still don't know what's going to be going on in a month from now.
That's correct. And that, I think for a lot of folks there, it's how do I deal with the situations at hand, as well as for the guys in agriculture, how do I do what normally I should be running 24/7 on trying to get stuff going for spring to go out and plant whatever, depending on size of your farm. And a lot of the farms in Ukraine are traditionally very big. It's run more of a corporate farming system where you've got 50,000 acres or et cetera to go farm. And so when you're doing that, you're running a really big machine of systems and process and people in order to do that. And today, that entire thing is in complete disarray. So it'll definitely be an interesting question as this crop year goes on and what that looks like. I fear for a lot of the production yields, as you look at the winter crops on the winter wheat and the rapeseed and the barley, I feel like there's going to be definitely a reduction regardless if this thing got sorted out and you go back to a normal farming system, just from a timing of getting nitrogen on your crops and getting ready to get out and get your first pass herbicide and fungicides and growth regulators on your rapeseed. All that stuff is potentially going to not happen or be delayed, which is it's less tools you've got in the box in order to try to go out and do a better job farming. My friend was telling me this morning, he said the Ukrainian government has talked about a 30% reduction in agriculture production alone just off of the ability for people to be able to get nitrogen and chemicals for what they're going to need. And I don't know if that accounts for loss of production in areas that aren't going to be able to produce or not. I'm not sure how far that extends on that 30% reduction.
You're a native Midwesterner, born, grew up in Iowa. Just describe a little bit about what Ukraine, what it was like to live there, what the people were like, and how you spent some of your 6 years there.
Yeah, so I'm a fifth-generation family farm kid from northwest Iowa. Had an opportunity in early 2008 to go over and set up a farm in Nikolaev, which is just north and east of Odessa, for an institutional investor actually out of the U.S. that had bought 7,500 acres of farm ground there, and it had been fallow since virtually 1993 when the Soviet Union fell. So took it and put it in production and got going on it, and then ended up staying through 2014 to do it. From a living standpoint, you know, it's a completely different world than what we know and live in. From the language is extremely challenging. Half the country from about Kyiv down to Odessa there, if you split about in the middle. The east side speaks Russian predominantly, and you go west and everybody speaks Ukrainian. It's kind of like Spanish and Portuguese. You can kind of understand the two, but they're different languages. So one is the language barrier there of trying to be able to communicate. Another one is technology and what we would have here take for granted for your ability to have things and do, from parts, supplies, inputs, and the type of things I'm not having there, that access to it. From a living standpoint, the Ukrainian people are fantastic. I mean, they're hard workers. they're smart, and they're good people. And I was actually there a total of 7 years, and in the 7 years I was there, I can honestly say I never had a situation where I was threatened or felt like I'm in a dangerous situation, et cetera, being in Ukraine. So, good place to live. It is Soviet style. I mean, you see the buildings that you see on TV in Kyiv or Odessa, the big cement suitcase-looking buildings, and that's predominantly what's there for housing for a lot of people in the cities. And then you get out in the villages, which is where your agriculture really takes place, and those villages are pretty simple. I have an American friend that lives in Ukraine with his wife out in the country in a village, and they don't have running water in their house. And hard to imagine the year 2022 that someone's got doesn't have running water in their house, but not all villages are like that. But there's a lot of it is just pretty simple and pretty basic living. They have gone through a lot of turmoil over the years, and so they probably have a bit different attitude and a different acceptance of that part of life. But all in all, living there, it's good. Good people, good food, great vodka, and honestly, there's some parts of Ukraine, and especially in western Ukraine, that are stunningly beautiful, like Lviv, Chernobyl, Ivano-Frankivsk, get over on that side. Some of those places remind you of Prague from a historic beauty standpoint. Heavily Orthodox Christian people and population. So, yeah, good place to live. Infrastructure, tough. A lot of the roads were just awful from a pothole standpoint. They've made a lot of progress in the last 5 years on improving that and in reducing a lot of the corruption, at least from what you deal with on a small scale standpoint that the commoner would deal with. But at the end of the day, a great country has absolutely beautiful farm ground. It's as good as central Iowa, central Illinois farm ground with really good organic matter, black, rich, beautiful soil. And depending where you're at on rainfall, some parts are drier, but there's a lot of growing areas there that get great rainfall and really great from a production standpoint. So it's a beautiful country and honestly great people in general, in my opinion, for a place to be.
Just a couple final questions for you. And knowing some of the history of Ukraine, Justin, does the 1930s forced famine of the USSR at that point in time weigh on those people? Does it at all ingrain what they do on the agriculture side of things to make sure something like that could never happen to their people again?
Yeah, it sure does. I'll tell you a quick story. So we used to pay our leases. They could be paid in cash or they could be paid in kind. And so you had a 100-hectare field, 250 acres, so you had 25 landlords in there. So when the Soviet Union fell, each person from that collective farm area was given a certain plot of land of acres. So 2.5 acres in a hectare, they might have got 4 hectares or 10 acres. And so that's what you call paye. And so you go pay them rent, and you would have a certain number of those people that want to be paid in kind. So they would want to be paid in gunny sacks full of wheat or barley, let's say, or corn, and wheat being by far the most common, the majority of what it was. And the reason they would do that is because they'd want to keep it to have an own feed source so they could have some chickens or a pig in the backyard or cattle or a dairy cow. So they'd have a grain supply source to be able to feed themselves in the case of an emergency that they didn't have food or in a famine situation, as well as cabbage, and I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but there's a number that under the old Soviet Union, everybody kept for cabbage. At the end of the year, you would basically slice like into coleslaw that they would keep, and that was originally designed because after the famine years that people had gone through, it was you need to keep enough food source that you can survive a winter if there's a famine, and I found that to be alarming in 2013, 2014, when you meet with people, and that's what they're doing. But the reality is that is ingrained through them, just like for a lot of the older generation, that either went through the Great Depression or their folks did to tell them about what it was like here. A lot of that is ingrained in them, probably better than it is here from a standpoint of keeping a food source for when the bad days come, and I think the bad days have probably come for them today.
On just a slightly lighter note, I think the one thing, people have been, at least in the ag side here in the United States, they find interesting is the number of farmers apparently pulling Russian tanks away with their tractors and dragging them someplace else. You know anybody that's done that at this point in time? Is that the spirit of the Ukrainian farmer to hook up a tractor and to move some piece of Russian military or artillery the hell out of the way and get it someplace else so they can't use it?
It's absolutely the spirit of the Ukrainians to hook onto something like that, especially being Russian, and take it, pull it off into a barn someplace and keep it for some day until they can sell it or take it out of harm's way. So, yeah, it's absolutely in the spirit of doing it. I don't know if I know anybody that's done it. So one of our old farm managers had posted a video of them with an MPZ, which is the little blue tractor, as you see, that are Russian and Ukrainian-made tractor, pulling one off. And we all thought that it was our old farm manager that did it, but I'm not sure if it was. It's hard to tell with social media where it actually came from and where that guy is at. I don't think that there's any tanks or heavy armor in that area yet, from what I understand. So I don't know of anybody personally today that has done it, but I would not put any of it past any of them to do that if the opportunity arises. So more power to them.
Do your friends over there tell you anything that the Ukrainian people need from us, or what could be done that, you know, we can do on a small scale?
You know, probably the biggest thing is I've had a request from one of my old farm managers for water. He's working with a water company that is trying to move 1 million bottles of water to people in that in the east, and so they're basically asking for donations for the water company on that. So that's one, and then probably money. But honestly, I think everybody over there needs that side. I made the comment to one of the guys. I said, I'd love to ship you a rifle and ammo. And he said, I would sure take it if I thought there was a way you could get it to me and get it in country. So I don't think that's an option. But, no, I think, honestly, probably just donations for them to be able to get supplies is the biggest thing. I think if people wanted to go on and sign some of the petitions to try to get the U.S. government to let some of these refugees that are stuck in Poland that have, especially the ones that have family in the U.S., to be able to move up the refugee status, to be able to come here would be wonderful. I've got some friends that have a mother-in-law and a sister-in-law and two little kids stuck in Poland right now that can't get, and they have been applied for visas for the U.S., a year ago, can't get the expedited process to get over to the U.S. or someplace where they can go. So I think any of those, if listeners can go on and do that, would be wonderful, and as well as donations for things for people, just for simple stuff like water and food that they can use over there for what they can get their hands on is going to be a definite need. There's a lot of these folks that have been coming out of Kyiv and going to out in the country. I have a friend from Boston, married to a Ukrainian. They're in a village 3 hours from Kyiv, and he's now taking in four families that have moved out of Kyiv that did not have anywhere to go. And I said to him yesterday, can I send you money? And he said, I don't know that I necessarily need the money today. He said, as long as we have enough food, we're going to get by. So I think if those are probably a couple things that listeners can do, is if you see the opportunity to donate to a group that's helping pay for supplies, most of which are going to come out of Europe, I think that was wonderful. And I think if you can sign any of these petitions to try to open some of that up, I think would be wonderful. One thing about the Ukrainian people is they're good, hardworking people. And when you take the I states out of Illinois, Indiana, in the Midwest, all of us in agriculture know the challenge of finding someone that can go drive a tractor well and show up and work hard. And there's a lot of those folks that would do a fantastic job if they could if they could get there and honestly fill some of the needs that we have. So that was probably my only couple comments on that side.
You have anything else you think we should know? Anything else you'd like to tell me or let the listeners know?
No, I mean, ultimately, I think as you watch what's going on there, you can watch that, what I call kind of that north-south corridor from Kyiv down to Odessa. And you can watch that piece. As you get further west of Kyiv, you become more in the Ukrainian speaking and more of the what I would call hardcore Ukrainian. And I'm not saying that people on the eastern side of Ukraine or east of Kyiv or east of the Dnieper River are not, but it's just a cultural shift of a very stout or patriotic Ukrainians. And as you watch this fight, if it ends up getting further west, I would say as you watch that, just hope that it doesn't, because that will turn into a literally every single door mentality. So keep that in your thoughts and minds. And honestly, I just said everybody, a lot of prayers for a lot of these families and kids that are going through this, as well as guys my age that worked on the farm today. Instead of sitting in a tractor doing what they would like to be doing, they're fighting on something that most of them have never had any intention or plan to do. So it's a sad situation, but hopefully we'll hopefully work out okay for them, and hopefully things will get held back to a point where it doesn't end up honestly getting to a door-to-door battle. I do not think you're going to see the Ukrainians step down or wave the white flag. It is not culturally in their mindset. If you were to go in Ukraine in 2008 and 2009, you could drive across that country and you wouldn't see a whole lot of Ukrainian flags. And my Ukrainian friends, when they'd come to the States with me, they'd say, man, there's an American flag on every house, on every building. The national pride that this country has is amazing. After what happened in 2012 with the Maidan Revolution and then Crimea and then the Donbass region in the east, you really saw a change in Ukraine. There's a huge amount of national pride for their country and patriotism, no different than we see in this country. So as you look at that, it's a very patriotic, proud country of proud people that are really honestly dealing with a terrible situation that they just never saw coming. Honestly, I had friends that I offered to have come here 2 or 3 days before that invasion started, and they just said to me, it'll never happen. Russia will never try to invade the entire country of Ukraine. It's the same issue we've been dealing with since 2012 of them putting threats out there. So I think it's a real big surprise that it actually happened and it's going down the way it is. So that's probably all I could say on that, other than, you know, keep those folks in your thoughts and prayers, because a lot of them are no different than us. They're just farm families trying to make a living that are dealing with a situation that they never thought they'd have to deal with.
You've been listening to the Newhoff Media Podcast Network. For more, visit newhoffmedia.com.